Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio on KVRF 89.5 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site. And you can find all of our episodes over on iTunes as well as on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Dog Works Radio. And today we're going to continue our Iditarod Musher series. We're going to talk to Gwen Bogart. She's calling in from Wasilla, Alaska. Gwen, how's it going?
Well, very good. I'm enjoying the sunshine.
It is a beautiful day up here in Willow. I think spring is in the air, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. The leaves are just popping out with all the sun and the long, long spring hours now that we're getting the sunshine. It's great.
You know, it's interesting that everything really slows down in the mushing world in this month of May. Everybody's kind of sitting back and relaxing, getting to think about those chores that we have to do in the summer to get ready for next fall and spring and all of that stuff that just kind of builds up very quickly as the weather turns cooler. What do you do in the off season to keep yourself busy?
Oh, my goodness. I do so many things. Well, I love to ride my road bike, so that's what I do for fitness work, for cardio and muscle work and stuff. Stack wood, cut down some trees, and just now I built a big Murphy bed for our guest room all by myself, and that's been a challenge, but I love to work with wood and use my power tools, dig in the dirt, plant in the garden, and, just lots of things like that.
You know, it does keep us busy. I know you're calling in from Wasilla, but before we get into talking about the Iditarod and all that it entails and what you're doing next year, can you introduce yourself to our audience? Where are you from? When did you get involved with mushing? How did you end up in Alaska? Whatever else you'd like to say.
Okay, sure. It's kind of an interesting tale. I'm from Vermont. I was born, raised and there and lived there for most of my adult life until 2009 when some friends of mine I come up to Alaska to fish a lot in the summertime. And these people have done tours of the Iditarod and said, gee, why don't you come up to Alaska and watch the Iditarod? You know, it's really fun. So I signed up for a trip in 2009, came up and watched the Iditarod from start to finish and all kinds of checkpoints in between, and I was fascinated with it. I've come from a life of training horses, and it's something that I did on a pretty intense level for many, many years. I had my own training facility. Christopher Reeve was one of my students well before he got hurt, but so I spent a lot of time training people and the horses, ran a boarding facility. I'm no stranger to hard work and training animals and whatnot. But so anyway, I came up and watched the Iditarod, and interestingly, I'd been divorced for about 15 years at that point, and I was not interested in looking for another relationship. I sort of dated Tom, Dick, and Harry about 5 times over and was done. You know, I just said, that's it. I don't want it. Dave Bogart in Nome on the ramp at the airport in 2009. And we ended up becoming friends. He lives here in Wasilla, and I was in Vermont. We ended up having a long-distance relationship, the ultimate, you know, like over 5,000 miles long-distance relationship. He's a pilot for FedEx, so he could fly back and forth for free, and that's how we ended up getting together, and we dated for about 3 years, and then we got married in 2012, and I moved up here, and I had made this proclamation to him that, you know, yes, I'll marry you, but I want to do the Iditarod, and are you with me or not, you know, so he gave me his blessing, and I first started working with Ray Reddington, and Ben Harper was my kind of my running mate, training me. You know, he'd get off the school bus and we'd go off training. So that was my first year and how I, you know, came about to running dogs. So, you know, it's quite a saga.
It is a saga. You know, Gwen, about a week or so ago, I ran into a guy over at Lowe's in Wasilla, and he was telling me how he was helping you out last year, cutting up your meat and doing all those extra chores. And he had told me a story about how you flew a little plane all the way across the country to Alaska. Can you tell us that story?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, oh, my goodness. So I got my pilot's license in 1997. And the reason I got my pilot's license was because I was really afraid of flying, really, really afraid of flying. And I thought that, well, you know, I got to get a grip on this. This is ridiculous. And why am I so afraid? Well, because I figured it was because I was ignorant. I didn't understand the dynamics of it. And the way I was going to face my fear and get over it was to learn about it and understand the forces and all of that. So I got my license in, I finally got my ticket in Florida. And because when I was in Vermont, the weather was bad and I couldn't keep my flying frequency up enough to stay really, you know, on top of it. So I visited a friend in Florida and stayed with her and flew nonstop for a couple weeks and really got good at it and went for my ticket and got it. So then with coming up to Alaska and fishing in the summer and the way to get out up here on the rivers, you know, we know that it takes an airplane. Well, I just got so fascinated by it, and I had a dream of one day being able to fly to Alaska myself. And so this opportunity came up where I had, it was in 2011, I drove a U-Haul truck filled with all of my stuff up here, all the way from Vermont, and two dogs. And then my boyfriend, Dave, and I flew his 180, Cessna 180 back to Alaska, and he was going to park it, or to Vermont from Alaska, and he was going to park it in Vermont, and we'd fly around in the summer when he would take time off from work, you know. So he sort of commuted from Anchorage to Alaska, you know, that, or from Vermont to Alaska. It sounds kind of crazy, but so when it came time in the fall to fly his airplane back north, we went to the Rutland, Vermont airport where I had had some friends and friends of a mechanic there. Mechanic said, hey, you guys, you know anybody that wants to ferry a Cessna 150 to Alaska? Well, I happened to be in the right place at the right time because that was one of my dreams. And I raised my hand, said, yes, I want to do it. So that's how that all got started. And it was an epic journey. It took forever to be able to get out of the Northeast because front after front after front of bad weather kept marching across the Northeast and we couldn't get out. There was no window of good weather to get out. We had to stall the trip for a month before we could finally get out. And I ended up taking about 2 weeks with weather. You know, we'd have to land and stay put for a day or two here and there because of bad weather and whatnot, and had engine trouble landed in Circle, Montana, and I said, I'm not going to fly that plane anymore. And we had a mechanic look at it, and I was getting carbon monoxide poisoning and, oh man, yada, yada. It was a lot. It's a story in itself. But yeah, so that was, you know, I mean, there were times when I wanted to just cry and fall down on the ground, stomping my feet from being so scared of the wind and the turbulence and kind of getting lost. And, you know, the GPS I had was ancient. The radio I had was ancient. Oh, it was just a very big challenge. But I made it, and I thought, well, if I can do that, I can do almost anything, you know.
You know, I thought that was such a cool story, and thank you very much for sharing that. Today we're talking to Gwen Bogart here on Mushing Radio. She is an Iditarod musher. She attempted the race last year, and we're going to jump into that right now. Gwen, was this past winter your qualifying year, or was it the year before? And if it was, who were you running with?
This winter I did have to get one last qualifier. The Iditarod Trail Committee allowed a bunch of us rookies to get our final qualifier and race the same year. So usually they don't allow you to do that. You have to have all your qualifiers prior to the year that you enter the race. But so I did, I got my last 300-mile race in the Copper Basin. And, you know, once I got that done, I felt like, okay, now that the big pressure is off, I'm qualified. But I've done, I did the Copper Basin 300 last year. And this year I did the Northern Lights. And last year the Northern Lights was canceled. The year before that I did the Sheep Mountain 200. They did a 200 and a 300 that year in March. So that was my first race that I'd ever done, that 200. So, you know, this will be my fourth winter mushing that we're going into. So,
you know, that's not a bad record at all. You know, I've been here 5 years and I'm still trying to get those qualifiers done. For one reason or another, they cancel or, you know, a leader gets hurt or whatever. So it's a tough task to do. So you signed up for this year's race just coming off the Copper Basin about a month and a half prior to the race. How did you feel going in? And then let's jump right into it. And how did you feel out there on the trail?
Actually, I was just thinking that it was the Northern Lights 300 that I did. I got my last qualifier with the Copper Basin, and then I did the Northern Lights 300 just for the good 300-mile training run. And I was having a hard time. I kind of hit an emotional wall, not feeling like I was having a good time. There were some major stresses in my life that I won't go into, but suffice it to say, there was some outside stresses that were really wreaking havoc with my general good outlook. And then I had some injury. I had a bad crash on my sled into a stream, went over a big embankment into the stream and separated my shoulder. So I was out for 2 weeks right before the Copper Basin, and I managed with physical therapy and get into that race and had a good time. But then going into the Copper Base or to the Northern Lights, I was just real stressed out. So it was tough mentally. You know, I really had a challenging time. The wind was picked up pretty strong on that race to the point where they held the race for quite a few hours. And I'd never encountered wind in my training. So it was a good thing to have, but it's scared me. I'll admit I had two very young leaders I was using in that race, and they had never been in that kind of weather before, so I was pretty worried about them being able to leave Finger Lake. When we were there, it was blowing a gale. I mean, this little tent that we were sleeping in down on the ice on Finger Lake, the whole thing was blowing apart. You know, it's just being whipped by the wind. And I was like, oh my goodness, you know, I don't know. And the snow's blowing sideways, and the dogs were not, they were ready to just stay on their beds, you know. They didn't really
right.
want to go. But another rookie, Mark Selland, who did end up finishing the Iditarod this year, a friend of mine came in and said, hey, Gwen, you know, I'm going to be leaving in about an hour. Do you want to travel together? So I was so glad that, you know, he came and got me, and we mushed the whole way back down to Yentna together, and that was a great run. So that kind of lifted my spirits and got me going. But by the time I got to the Iditarod, I was like, you know, I was pretty whipped from the injuries and not in the best frame of mind, to say the least. But I'm like, okay, I'm going to go. I'm going to do this. I'll get out there with the dogs, be on my own, and all the other stuff of the winter will just melt away, and it'll be great. So, you know, do you have any other questions before I kind of continue on with
this? No, jump right in. We've got about 15 minutes or so to go, so jump right in.
All right. So the start, as we know now, was in Fairbanks, and, you know, they really put on the start was great and lots of people and fun, but I was pretty overwhelmed. You know, you spent so much time thinking about this, started it, you know, being in the Iditarod, and oh my gosh, you know, it was like so much bigger than me in my mind, you know, and oh my gosh, here I am. I'm at the start of the Iditarod, really? You know, holy cow. And everything I've worked so hard for, and here I am. So, I had two dogs that got injured right before the race with mild shoulder injury, so I decided to stick with just my 14 dogs and not try to inject two new creatures into the team. I thought, well, I just want to go with what I know. So I thought there's no reason why I can't do this with 14. That should be fine. So, you know, the start, the first run down to Nenana, the trail was pretty good all the way down the river, and was a gorgeous day, and it was, you know, like, I don't know, 10 below zero maybe to 10 above, that, you know, temperature was really good. Had a good run, everything was great. And then got to Nenana, and the dogs were, you know, really good, and my schedule was a six on, six off rest run schedule, and I felt really good with that, and that's what I ended up training, and so I felt like that parameter, six on, six off, was really comfortable for me and for the dogs. And we got ready and left Nenana to camp out to make it to the next checkpoint, Manly Hot Springs. So we were going to do, I think it was 40 miles and then rest and then another 40 miles. And so that night it got really cold. It was probably 30 below. And it was, yeah, it was uncomfortable. It wasn't, I wouldn't say it was fun, but I did it, you know, and okay, I'll be glad to see the next checkpoint. And got into Manly, and I just was not having a good time. By the time I got there, I was pretty down on the dumps, and I will tell you that I did want to scratch. And I was there with my friend Jan Steve, and she and I ended up going and, you know, spending time and took a nap together and got all our clothes dried out and had some food, and we got up and we were going to go, and she was ready and I wasn't. I was like, wait a minute, I haven't taken care of myself. I'm not in good shape. And so I said, you go, Jan. I'll see you later. And I went back to the coffee and just kind of tried to get myself cooked up. And it was there that I talked to Art Church, who was one of the race judges. And he tried to, you know, get me to, you know, keep going. And no, you don't want to scratch. You'll be fine. You know, what's wrong? And he was a, you know, he was a good supporter, and I was really ready to call it quits. I just was miserable. And but he said, you know, just get to the next checkpoint, and you'll be okay. You know, you'll have a good run, and it'll all work out. And I was like, all right, okay, I'm going to do it. And he was right. I had a great run. And when I got to Tanana, I broke through that barrier of, I'm not having fun, I want to scratch. And it was like an epiphany to be able to say, all right, I've left the black stuff behind, you know. I've got that monkey off my back, and I'm on my way. I'm really excited. And the people at Tanana, the checkpoint, were fantastic. I mean, they just were the most kind, and tons of food, and just really, really nice. And anyway, I was due to pull the hook and set out on the 120-mile run down to Ruby, 30 in the afternoon. And I was, you know, it's really psyched. And so headed out, and it was, you know, we knew it was going to be cold, probably 40 below, you know. And I thought, well, okay, I'm ready. I've got my clothes. I've got everything. I've, you know, prepared enough for this. I think I can do it. And got going, and well, about 25 miles in, the dogs, they kept kind of stopping. You know, they were, they'd stop, and I'd say, what the heck? You know, I'd set the hook and run up and say, hey, you guys, come on, good job. You know, we're all good. This is good. And then, come on, all right, let's keep going. And finally, they just, they quit. They didn't want to go anymore. And I thought, well, all right, then let's just stop here, and I'll feed them and take a break, and, you know, we'll have to do this in three runs instead of two. Well, then it was then when I realized, I looked in my sled, and I had not packed enough meals for this three-stop, and
right,
there was no way I was going to make it with the extreme temperature. And by then, I don't know what the temperature was, but it was really, really cold. You know, I knew I'd never felt anything like that. Well, so as Jan Thief came along, because she came into Tanana a little bit ahead of me, and she came along, and we had planned to run together. I said, Jan, I don't have enough food to make this, and I'm going to have to scratch. And she's like, no, don't. And I'm like, no, I don't have enough food. And she didn't have enough food either, because we both had planned on just running the 120 miles in two runs, but it wasn't working out that way. So I let the dogs rest for a while, and, you know, about 4 hours later, that's it. I can't do it. I'm going to have to turn around and go. So I gave Jan the whatever snacks I had, a thermos of coffee, you know, all my hand warmers, everything, toe warmers I had, so she could go on. And I said, I'm done. I'm going back. And so I went the 25 miles back, and Karen Ramstead was the judge there, and she was really kind and said, why don't you just pack up more food and go? You know, you can keep going. And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, I'm going to be so far behind the last people that I don't want to get the dreaded call that says, come on, you've got to pick it up. You know, you can't rest 6 hours. You're going to have to, you know, you got to push. You got to keep going. And I know that I couldn't deal with that kind of stress trying to play catch up.
Right.
And I couldn't put that pressure on the dogs either, because I just knew it'd be such a negative for me. And I said, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to pull out. It just wasn't fair to the dogs and to me, and that kind of pressure. So I thought, well, you know, I don't know. My husband and I had made a pact that we weren't going to do this again. But once I got home after a week, I said, honey, what would you think if I told you to want to run the Iditarod again? And he'd say, well, I think I'd try to talk you out of it. But he never did. He didn't try to talk me out of it, because he knew I wanted to do it again, and he's been behind me 100%. So
We're going to talk about that in just a second, but I do have a couple of questions for you, if you don't mind, Gwen. Today we're talking to Gwen Bogart here on Mushing Radio. My first question is, I guess it's more of a statement. I've spoken to at least 15 or 20 or so folks here on the show since the race has been over, and everybody has said pretty much the same thing. That section of the trail kicked their butt, and it's mainly because of the temperatures, especially folks in the Matsu Valley that train down here. We don't see temperatures like that. What did you do when you were thinking about it? You know, and here you are at 50, 60, 70 below zero at that section of trail. How did you wrap your head around that when you're thinking, oh my God, here I am in the middle of nowhere, and it's the coldest I've ever been?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think fortunately I did not have a thermometer on my sled, so I didn't really know the number, you know.
Right.
All I knew is that it felt like nothing I've ever felt before. You know, any exposed skin was, you know, it froze faster than anything I'd ever experienced before. My sled bag, which was packed full of stuff, of course, you know, in other races, I'd lie down on my sled and throw my sleep over me, and that would be fine. Well, this time, it was lying down on the sled, even with my pad under me. The cold that seeped into my body from the cold of the sled and the pad, which good that I could tell in terms of warmth, you couldn't sleep, you know?
Right.
There just was no sleeping. The hardness of everything. And, you know, just to change your socks. I mean, I had to debate with myself because every little thing that you need to do makes it that much more difficult, you know? So it's like, you got to change your socks. Your feet are damp. You know, no, I don't want to. It's so cold. I can't, you know, no, you've got to, you know? And I found out when I got back to Tanana that night at the Tanana airport, it was 47 below zero. And the guys, the local guys at the checkpoint said that where we were down on the river, it's 10 degrees colder. So it was 57 below down there, and I believe it. But,
right.
You know, out of that, for me as a rookie and not have experienced any of that, now that I've experienced that little bit, I kind of can figure out, you know, what I need to do in the future going forward. So as bad as it was and having to scratch and all that, at least the good is I've learned how to cope with it. And, you know, I'm not lying. I was scared out there, you know.
Right.
And now I don't feel like I'm going to need to be frightened because I am going to survive it. I know what I have to do. And so, you know, in hindsight, it was horrible being such a rookie at this. I mean, I'm a rookie, you know?
Right.
Very, very inexperienced. So it was really a great thing for me to go through to help pump up my tires, so to speak.
Gwen, do you mind if we stay over just a few minutes? I want to make sure that we finish our interview. Do you have some time?
I do, yep.
Okay, good, good. My next question is again, more of a statement and then kind of a follow-up with that. As a rookie, first off, when you're on a sled, can you describe that to our listeners? You know, most people that are listening cannot fathom what it takes to do 300, 400, 500 miles on a trail. And I don't think I've ever asked this to anybody, but a lot of people have. What is it like to sit there on the back of the sled where you're going 5 or 6 or 7 miles an hour and all you have are your thoughts? And like you said, do I change my socks? No. Do I change my clothes? No. You know, all these things just kind of go in slow motion, I guess is the best way to put it. Can you tell us about that, on what's kind of going through a musher's mind when you're standing there and not doing a whole lot except having those thoughts?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I've said to a couple of different people, you know, sometimes 10 miles on the sled seems to go by a lot faster than 10 miles in the car. And, you know, your mind is just so busy watching every dog and every stride and any sign of any of the dogs having an issue. So focused on all of those creatures out in front of you that are taking care of you, basically getting you down the trail. So as much as it seems like you're just standing there, you're mentally, you're just watching. And then if you're on a trail that is contoured or whatnot, you know, not a river, but, you know, has topography to it, sled riding skills and whatnot. But it's really the focus on the dogs. You're just so intensely focused that time just seems to go by, you know?
Right.
It's kind of, And that's why I say, you know, 10 miles on a sled seems to go by faster than 10 miles in a car. It's just kind of funny that way, but that's the way it is.
So let's jump into the upcoming race. You had mentioned a couple of minutes ago that shortly after you were done, you had that discussion with your husband, and you said, we're going to do this again. And I remember when you announced it on Facebook that you were going to be running with Vern Halter's team, Dream a Dream Dog Farm, which is right up the street literally from us and on our trails here to train. What made you make that step? I know you've worked with other mushers in the past. You're really working with somebody special when you're working with Vern. How did you make that decision?
Well, several reasons. I don't have my own dogs because it's not a lifestyle for me. It is a bucket list. And if you don't have your own dogs, then what are you going to do? You know, you can lease a team. And so I leased the team for 2 years from Jason Mackey. Wonderful dogs. You know, I had a team this year that was just fantastic. And ultimately, there's no reason why they couldn't have done it. You know, I was certainly the weak link. There's no doubt about it. But you know, Jason was really busy with his goals of running the race. And, you know, it's kind of hard when you're a real rookie like me. I mean, I put myself in his shoes, and I think, you know, pretty hard for him to focus on me and himself and get me, you know, give me more knowledge on what to do. I mean, you know, a guy can only tell a person how much. You know, you have to get out there and learn it.
Right.
And the reasons why I didn't do it weren't any, you know, lack of ability on Jason's part, other than that just Mother Nature hadn't given me the mileage, you know. As you know, right, living in the Matsu Valley, we didn't have any cold temperatures. We don't have any wind. We, you know, it's like the banana belt down here. So, anyway, so, you know, after the Iditarod, the team that I had, Jason, had sold, and I knew, what am I going to do? Who am I going to, and Jason's goals for going forward have changed. So he didn't have the dog. So what was I going to do? So I knew I needed someone to kind of, if you will, hold my hand through the process of training. And someone who, that's what they do. You know, they bring people like me along, like, you know, Cindy Abbott, for example. Wow, I mean, he worked with her, and she's done a fantastic job with her handicaps. You know, I thought, wow, well, maybe this would be the venue for me to go. So my husband and I went and talked to Vern, and I'd gotten to know him here and there, you know, just through being part of racing, and he was on the trail with Cindy during the Northern Lights in the Copper Basin, and we were always kind of leapfrogging and, you know, watching him with Cindy and her with him, and I thought, you know, it just seemed like a really good relationship. So that's kind of why I sort of connected the dots and thought, all right, well, is this something that I could do? And when I called him, wrote him a note and said I wanted to try again, and did he have space? And he said yes, so the timing was right and everything fell into place.
So are you running in 16? Are you taking a year off to work with Vern? Are you jumping right back into it?
I'm jumping right back into it. Yeah. I'm going to be 58 for this year's Iditarod. I'm no spring chicken, as my stepmom would say. I've had a very physically active life with horses and training and crashing and burning and lots of soft tissue damage, and arthritis is creeping in quickly. And if I take a year off, I don't know if I'll get to the starting line again. So I want to keep going while I have the strength, the physical strength and the motivation. So I'm jumping right in.
Gwen, I have one final question, and I want to make sure that we mention how to get in touch with you and how to follow you along. You had said a couple of times through this interview that you were a rookie's rookie. You came into the Iditarod as a true rookie. And there's always a lot of talk about how the qualifiers don't quite prepare us for what we're going to face on the Iditarod. What is your response to that, and what do you think they could do to change, if they could do anything?
Well, part of me, I think that the Copper Basin should be a mandatory qualifier, you know, that caliber of race, because and the last 2 years haven't really proven that, but I mean, you know, last year, not this past winter, but the winter before, we had an epic water crossing, you know, and it said that if you can do the Copper Basin, you can do the Iditarod. Well, you know, I think maybe if, you know, I run the Copper Basin again, maybe this year it'll be super cold. That would be great training. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't think necessarily raising the miles that you have to have racing to qualify should be done. I think what it is it should be fine. It's kind of the sort of the luck of the draw. I mean, you want to go into a race and not have to suffer too much, but then you kind of, you know, sort of cutting off your nose to spite your face. You really want to have as much adverse conditions to mush in, because that's what's going to qualify you, you know. I mean, truly.
Right.
And nobody has any control over that, you know. So the terrain of the Copper Basin, the water crossings, the, you know, the weather up there can be pretty epic. So, you know, I don't know. I just think someone like me, you know, saying to somebody else that's like me that has, it's not their life, so just do as many races as you can, because you want
right.
to put yourself sort of in harm's way and see if you're mentally capable of it and that you can cope with it, and it, you know, gives you the confidence that you can survive this stuff. So I think it's just race as much as you can. Get out there as much as you can. Do whatever you can to face all kinds of challenges.
I think those are all great points, Gwen, and I agree with you. I think that the Copper Basin should be a mandatory qualifier. It's, you know, similar to other types of sports where you have to do one particular event before you can do another. I think that, at least for folks up in Alaska, that would definitely prepare them, because, you know, many folks just do races like the Kinnick 200 and the Tustamina and these shorter races, and then do one or two relatively easy 300s, and they're ready to go. And you often see those folks really struggle on Iditarod because they haven't done races like the Copper Basin. So I think that's a great idea, and I'm sure that the trail committee or whoever makes those decisions are always thinking about that, because I'm sure that they don't want to see the rookies out there really struggling either, don't you think?
I agree. I mean, it certainly felt like, you know, they did want everybody to try to, you know, get to the finish line. And, you know, I felt ported. You know, I mean, it's serious business out there. And, you know, you really have to have your head about you and be brutally honest with yourself. And what can I do, or what can I do? Should I go out in this storm? Shouldn't I? You know, for me, I was like conservative. I needed to be conservative because they weren't my dogs. You know, I'm leasing this team, and I'm not gonna put them out into that, because, you know, darn it, you can die out there, and I don't want to be the first person to die on the Iditarod, or maybe responsible for my dogs dying because I don't know what I'm doing. You know,
right.
I couldn't possibly have that on me.
Well, I think you have one heck of a mentor coming up this year, and he is known for running a very conservative type schedule with his mushers. So I think you'll do very well. We'll definitely keep in touch, and I'm sure I'll see you out there on the trails many times this coming winter if we have snow. I think that's the big if, especially over the last couple of years. Gwen, I know I've kept you over. How do we get in touch with you? Do you have a website, Facebook page? How are folks communicating with you before we lead up to the next race?
I have a website. It's called FromHomeToNome.com. And I have a Facebook page which has lots of different names on it, so people from my high school days can remember that it's me. But it's Gwen Wizzle Perkins Bogart. So
very good.
Yeah, I always love to get, you know, people saying, "Hey, we're wishing you the best," or whatnot. You know, you just can't have enough support. So to hear from everybody.
Now, are you still operating your crowdfunding program that you had up a little while ago?
Yes, and that's From Home to Nome at GoFundMe.com.
Okay, so GoFundMe.com/From Home to Nome, right?
Yes, that's right. That's correct.
Okay, I'll make sure I put all these links on your page, and that way folks can interact with you if they wish. Gwen, it is a pleasure to talk with you, and good luck this coming year, and we'll see each other on the trail, okay?
Yeah, thank you, Robert. Thanks for the opportunity to speak, and I do look forward to seeing you.
Very good. Gwen Bogart, Iditarod Musher, going to be training with Vern Halter this coming winter. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.
Thank you.